The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Any questions? Anything that, any loose ends I can tie up? Because they can't, see, they can't marry someone who hasn't converted, who hasn't discovered
it. You can't hurt her first.
But a Muslim man can marry a non-Muslim woman.
Evangelist.
Economic incentives. Okay. Any other questions? Getting ready to get into the Quran, right? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, we'll do the Quran, and we might do the next one. What is the next one? Hadith. And then we'll call it a day. Sunnis and Shiites?
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. We've got to do Sunnis and Shiites first. Okay. All right. And in the Quran, I will give you the foundation of some stuff we were talking about earlier. Yes.
So my understanding of Islam, I mean, before you go over the types of well, at least with the attacks on the U.S. was the Israeli occupation, or just the nation of Israel. And that's, I thought, what the biggest problem was for the West, their support of the nation.
Well, that's part of it, yeah, sure. Because Israel is a non-Muslim entity in the middle of Muslim territory. I mean, how would you feel if, well, let's say these were the days of the Cold War, how would you feel if Kansas was a Soviet outpost? You understand what I'm saying? You know, that's kind of how they look at it. I mean, I'm not saying that's a legitimate thing, but yeah, Israel is a non-Muslim entity in the middle of what they consider to be their territory. And there are some other things too. There's the long-standing hostility towards Jewish people that Muslims have had for a long time.
So, like theoretically, if Israel was somehow not a nation anymore, and that became a Muslim nation, jihad would still continue.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, that wouldn't change a thing. That would probably embolden them. Check this out. You know when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that he wants to wipe Israel off the face of the map? Mm-hmm. Okay, you know who he's talking about? This isn't in his defense, but I do understand what he was actually saying. Okay, here's, okay. All right. I'm getting better at this. Okay, here's the Gaza Strip, right? And here's the West Bank. West Bank, I don't know, or something like that, I don't know. All right. Okay, and then all the rest of this is Israel up to Jordan. How does Jordan fit in anyway? I forgot. All right. Okay, so here's Israel, right? Israel, here's the Golan Heights, you know. Okay, all right, here's Israel, and here's the West Bank, and here's the Gaza Strip. Okay, so when he talks about wiping Israel off the face of the map, what he is saying is simply eliminating Israel as an entity and making all this one thing. We just call that Palestine, that's all. He wasn't talking about nuking Tel Aviv. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, he's talking about reshuffling it so that you don't have a Jewish entity there anymore. That's all. As a matter of fact, in Saudi Arabia and other places, when they talk about Palestine, they don't even show Israel there. They just call it Palestine. And so it has this look that these Jews are illegitimately occupying, you know, the land. But you know, in the 1948 thing, when they partitioned Israel, I think 98.5% of the land on which Israel was established was already owned by Jews. Okay. And I think when Yasser Arafat had that meeting with Clinton, remember? Ehud Barak offered Arafat 98% of the land that belonged to Palestine prior to the 1967 war. But for that extra 2%, he made up by carving out part of Israel to compensate for that. And Yasser Arafat didn't go for it. Okay. Now, part of the reason that Yasser Arafat didn't go for it, okay, now we've got two things. We've got the World War IV has begun, for those I did the temporary thing with. You didn't get that, so I got that. And the rest of this is where we're going to go. Who needs World War IV? Okay. All right. But Yasser Arafat couldn't accept that. If he had accepted it, he would have been dead inside of a week. Okay. Because he would have been judged to have left Islam. He would have been judged to have committed apostasy. Because by agreeing with Israel on that thing, he was agreeing to the existence of Israel. And that was too much of a concession to make. Okay. All right. Okay, we can get on into like 40 voicemails. Everybody wants to call me when I'm up teaching. Huh? Oh, that's Chattanooga.
Hey,
yeah, we got the aquarium. As a matter of fact, we got a new aquarium now. That's right here. You know. And this is the you can see that's the Southern Queen, the Southern Belle or whatever. You can take a cruise and have dinner. So if anybody wants to come to Chattanooga, you know, go on the Southern Bell. All right. Where's that Ireland? Yeah. I hear that in my mind. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I got a focus. Okay. All right. I thought that was interesting. It looked nice and purple, you know? Oh, boy. That's great. Okay. Okay. We gotta have some fun, right? Okay, I'll get you out of here at 4:00. Okay, we'll either be a little early or we'll be a little late. Now you know where my leaning is. Yeah, I don't want to abrogate stuff. Okay. All right. So here's the Quran. We're going to get into the Quran. And this is interesting stuff, you know. And it'll, again, this is for your wisdom, okay? When Muslims will tell you that they believe, you know, they accept your Bible, but the way they do and the way they don't. Okay. According to Muslims, what is the source of the Quran? I think I alluded to this before. The source of the Quran is something called the Eternal Tablet. The Eternal Tablet. And this tablet sits at the right-hand side of Allah. Okay? Kalam. Kalam is our Arabic word for word. So it's Allah Kalam. Word of Allah. And it sits at the right-hand side of the throne of Allah. Okay. Now, this Eternal Tablet has 104 divisions in it. And at various times of history, Allah has sent down these divisions to mankind. He sent down all 104 divisions. But 100 of these divisions no longer survive on earth. And only 4 survive. Okay? Only 4 survive on earth. Okay. So 100 of these no longer survive. Only 4 survive. So remember, they all come from the eternal tablet. Okay? All right. Now, let's look at the 100 non-surviving divisions of the eternal tablet. Okay? Alright. These things were sent down at various times. Okay, 10 of these divisions were sent down to Adam. Alright. 50 were sent down to Seth. 30 were sent down to Enoch. And 10 were sent down to Abraham. Okay? So that makes up your 100. So all those divisions, they were sent down, but they don't exist on earth anymore. Okay? Now we'll look at the 4 surviving divisions that were sent down. Okay, the 4 surviving ones. All right. The law or the Torah was sent down to Moses. The Psalms or Zabur was sent down to David. The Gospel or Injil was sent down to Jesus. And the Quran was sent down to Muhammad. So theoretically, the Muslims accept the revelation which came down to us. But when you bring yours out, they'll say it's corrupted. Okay? But how do they know it's corrupted? How do they know our Bible's corrupted?
Because it doesn't matter which match what came later.
It doesn't match with the Quran. You know? How do you know that Einstein's theory of relativity is not right? Because it doesn't agree with Big Bird on Sesame Street. Right? Okay. All right. That's, I thought I'd throw that out there. That might be a little deep. But anyway. Okay. All right. So, that's the eternal tablet. Okay. So now you know where the Quran fits. Yes.
But just a short question for the Injil. Is that just like the Gospels, or is that the whole New Testament?
The Gospel.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't accept, technically they don't accept the letters. But it doesn't matter. If you're going to talk to a Muslim, use everything. Because generally speaking, they don't, you can say, well, the Bible says so and so and so. And remember, the Word of God won't return anything. Okay, here are our beliefs about the Eternal Tablet. This is interesting. Most Muslims in the world believe the Eternal Tablet to be uncreated. Because Kalam is a characteristic of Allah. As long as Allah has been around, Kalam has been around. So therefore, the Eternal Tablet is uncreated. But most American converts to Islam believe the Eternal Tablet to be created. Can anybody guess why? You know, tap water does taste a little different. I don't know. Maybe they put that flavor in the tap water to make you go buy the water. You know. Okay. Check this out. The reason that most American converts believe that it's created because they understand the implications of an uncreated eternal tablet. Again, I'll go back to a conversation I had with an imam several years ago. We were having a dialogue, right? And he said, he was talking about, I raised my hand and says, doesn't the Quran come from an uncreated book? He said, wait. He said, if we start talking about an uncreated Quran, then pretty soon we're going to start talking about an uncreated Jesus. And I said, exactly right. Because he's a disgruntled Baptist, And so he understood the implication of that. So if we start talking about an uncreated Quran, then it became very easy to talk about Jesus being uncreated and all that.
Okay.
If he's the Word of God, see, then I could have made that argument.
Okay.
All right. Okay, I said most, but most Muslims in the world believe it to be uncreated. Okay, now, how was the Quran compiled? Well, first of all, Muhammad was illiterate. And therefore, he never wrote anything down, right? He died without leaving a written record of his recitations. So what do? Well, guess what? Many of his followers memorized parts of what he recited. And so they said, on such and such occasion, he said so-and-so and so-and-so. All right? And different followers recited different versions of his recitations. Okay? Now, in some cases, they wrote some of this stuff down on fig leaves and stuff like that. All right. So, you know, Rashid would say, on such an occasion, Muhammad said so and so and so. Okay? And then Saeed would say, no, that's not right. He said so and so then. And they get to fighting. And say, oh, let's go see the Prophet. So they go see the Prophet. And what did Muhammad say? Muhammad himself claimed that Allah had given him 7 different versions of the recitations. So he used a nice dialectical tool there. You know? Less filler. Tastes great. And it said, middle light. Okay. All right. You know, there's nothing wrong with a little dialectical stuff. Okay. All right. So that solved that dispute, but then that would come up later on. Okay. So 1 year after the death of Muhammad, there was a battle of Aqaba. And most of the best reciters were killed. Okay. And so this was a great crisis. This is a great crisis for the Muslim community. Why? Because they were about to lose the words of their prophet. Alright? They were about to lose the words of their prophet. So, who became the caliph after Muhammad?
Abu Bakr.
So, Abu Bakr is elected. And what does he do? He decides that he is going to compile the Quran, the written thing. So, alright, so he becomes the first caliph after Muhammad. And so he gathered Muhammad's recitations, which had been written down, because by this time, some of the stuff that had been written down was eaten by the camels. You know, these fig leaves and stuff, they'd written on bones and all that. So he got all that together. And then he got all the reciters, the remaining reciters, and assigned scribes to them. And had them write it down. And of course, you know the different reciters remember different versions of his recitations, right? Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And so you had different versions of the Quran, right? Mm-hmm. All right. But unfortunately, within a few years, Muslims were going to war against each other and killing each other over different versions of the Quran. You know? Kind of like War of the Roses, you know. War of the Qurans. Alright. So what are you going to do? Well, Abu Bakr didn't live to do much about it because he was what? Assassinated. And then Omar, right? He was assassinated. Well, alright. So, Uthman then becomes the fourth caliph under he becomes the third caliph, rather, after Muhammad. All right, so what he did, he commissioned the second gathering of the Quran. So he said, okay, stop, everybody out of the pool. Okay, let's call a timeout. Bring everybody back together. BYOQ. So everybody brought the Qurans and all that, right? Okay, so God gathered all the Qurans, right? Then he collected all the remaining manuscripts, and he and his companions edited the one they had, okay, and he kept it, and Aisha, Muhammad's second wife, kept it, right? All right, so his Quran then became the standard, and he compared all the other manuscripts with the one he had, and anyone that deviated in the slightest way was considered invalid. All right, so what does he do? He burned. You like my fire? He burned the remaining, the ones that deviated. All right, he burned all of them, or he thought he burned all of them. And so the result is the Uthmanic version of the Quran, which is the one we have today. Okay. Now, interesting. A year and a half ago, some of those variant manuscripts we discovered some of those things survived. And they were found in Yemen. And the Muslim community is holding its breath right now because they don't know what to do. They're told not to question all of this stuff, all right? So anyway, that's interesting. Kind of keep your ear to the ground to hear what happens, all right? So that's the Quran we have today, the Uthmanic version, okay? All right, now, we're talking about some other characteristics of the Quran, not only how it was compiled, but then how then did the Quran actually get to us, all right? The inspiration of the Quran, okay? How does it come? Well, the Muslims, their concept of inspiration is the word wahi, which is dictation. It's just straight up dictation, all right? Dictation. Wahi. All right. Now, how did wahi come? The Quran tells us that it came in several ways, this dictation, okay? First, it describes it comes from behind the veil. You know, the dictation came from behind the veil. Oh, by the way, if any of y'all see any typos in this stuff, would you please let me know? I think I've got them all out, but, you know, you never know. I don't claim inerrancy yet. You know. Okay, I only claim inerrancy in the original autographs. And they weren't written, they were only in my mind, you know. Okay, all right. It came through an angel appearing as a young man. It came through seeing an angel in an angelic form. It came through the sound of ringing bells. You hear these bells ringing, and why he would come. Through the sound of metal being beaten. Through dreams. Sometimes he'd wake up, oh, I had a dream about this. This is the recitation of that. Through seeing visions while awake. And through being taken to highest heaven. There's a story told in the Hadith that Muhammad, you know, he went to Jerusalem, you know that one, and he ascended into heaven to talk to Allah. And they talked about several things, but one of the things at the time was Allah was demanding 50 times a day for prayer. And Muhammad was able to negotiate, and he got it down to 5. Hey. Alhamdulillah. Okay, alright, so that's, according to the Quran, those are the ways in which the wahi came, alright. Okay, according to the Hadith, Muhammad went through certain things, he experienced certain things when wahi came. What did he experience during wahi, alright? Okay, we know the first one, he experienced suffocation. You know, the very first verses recited came as Muhammad was almost choked to death. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't remember the Bible. I don't remember God ever trying to choke somebody, trying to reveal himself to you. I don't know. Maybe I don't know all of it. Oh, I know where. I think it's in 3 Kings. Okay, all right. Sometimes he'd have fits. He'd go through fits. Sometimes he'd change, his color would change. Sometimes he'd snore as if he was asleep, and sometimes he'd rattle like a young camel. There's a doctor, a neurologist, who has written a book called Life Alert, The Medical Case of Muhammad, and he points out that Muhammad showed the classic signs of a rare case of epilepsy, and that explains all of that. Okay, it's an expensive book, that's why I didn't put it on your list. It's not all that important, but anyway. Interesting book. All right. So that's what he went through as wahi came. All right. Now, how then is the Quran organized? Okay. How is it organized? Okay. The arrangement of the 114 surahs. There are 114 surahs in the Quran. How is it organized? It is organized in the following way. From according to importance and length. Okay. In other words, from the longest to the shortest, with the exception of the first surah. The first surah is very short. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You heard people recite that before. Let's see if I can find this thing here. Yeah. This one's done politically correct, isn't it?
Oh yeah. You got to do it this way, right?
I have no idea.
Yeah, you got to. It goes backwards like our like the Hebrew Bible. Nah, I have trouble reading these all English translations. You know? Okay. There's the cow. Yeah. Praise be to God, Lord of the universe, compassionate, the merciful, the sovereign of the day of judgment. You alone we worship, and to you alone we turn for help. Guide us through to the straight path, the path of those whom you have favored, not of those that have incurred your wrath, nor of those who have gone astray. And that's it. It's only seven verses in the first surah. That's it. So actually the longest surah then is surah number two, the cow. Okay? Alright. Each surah is named after an event in it. So the second surah is called the cow. There's a surah called the woman, the table, the Imrans, Jonah, Joseph, the bee, the cave, the prophets, pilgrimage, the story. All of these things are names. These are the names of the surahs. But most Muslims, when they refer to the Quran, they refer to the number of the surah. Okay? That's what I did earlier. Remember, I told you. Okay. All right. Surah is singular. Surat is plural. Surat is plural. Okay. All right, so the second surah, the cow, is the longest one. Okay, now, here are the subdivisions of the 114 surahs, okay? There are two basic subdivisions. There are two basic types of the surahs. The earlier surahs recited in Mecca, okay? The earlier surah, the Meccan surahs. How do you tell when you have a Meccan surah? Usually it starts off with the phrase, O mankind, okay? Or O ye people, something like that, okay? All right, there it is, O ye people. And then you got the later surahs, they're recited in Medina, and they usually start off with the phrase, O ye who believe, all right. Now, so you got the earlier ones, the Meccan ones, and you got the later ones, the Medina ones. I'm giving you the basis of abrogation in a minute, okay? All right, now, that's it. And there are contradictions between those two subdivisions, okay? The earlier surahs, 86 of those were recited, and the later ones, 28. Okay? The earlier surahs, there you go, 86, they tend to be lofty, spiritual, pure, tolerant, and concerned with social justice. In other words, they're warm and fuzzy. The warm, fuzzy verses. Muslims will go around and they'll quote this stuff. And these are wonderful passages of the Quran. Okay, then you got the 28 remaining ones, the ones recited in Medina. All right? And they tend to be, there's 28 of those, they tend to be more practical, community-oriented, harsh. Kill the infidels, fight those who don't believe in the last day, etc., etc., etc. Militaristic, endorsing war and repressive measures towards non-Muslims to advance Islam. Okay, got it? How do you tell a Medinan surah? It usually starts off with, O ye who believe, Medinan. Meccan, O ye people, or O mankind. All right. And it was interesting when I talked about, well, anyway, these guys started quoting these passages, and everybody went, oh, that's Meccan. Okay. All right. Now, that's important. Now, why do you think the Meccan surahs are warm and fuzzy and the Medinan surahs are cold and prickly? Why do you think? Okay. Yeah.
The Meccan ones were done before he got sisters out of town.
That's right. And he was surrounded, but he was still surrounded by enemies in Mecca. Okay? All right? Now, in Medina, Muhammad became the dictatorial, iron-fisted leader. Okay? In Mecca, Muhammad, being surrounded by enemies, was reaching out to Christians and Jews for strategic alliances. You see? You know, we're all in this together, y'all. Right? But when he gets to Medina, he doesn't need them anymore. Okay? The moderate Muslims who say Islam is a religion of peace, which surahs do they quote? Mecca. Bin Laden, and all those guys, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, all those guys, they quote the Medina ones. But which ones are the true ones? The Medina ones, and I'll show you why later. Okay, so those are the things. Now that you got to understand. See, you got to understand that. Some Qurans will tell you if it's a Medinan one or if it's a Meccan one. Okay, let me see here. I'm just going to pick a surah at random and see if we can figure it out. Alright, yeah, we'll finish Quran and that'll be it. Okay. 4:15. These verses in here are long. Oh, you people. There it is. Have fear of your Lord. What's that?
Mecca.
Here's another Mecca one. Oh, people. Alright. And you just go through it. It's amazing how consistent that is. It doesn't always do that. I say usually it starts off like that. Okay? Anyway. Alright, so that's how you can tell. Okay. Now, yeah, tomorrow we'll talk about what's the next one here? Oh, Sunnis and Shiites. Okay, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay, so that's the thing about the Quran. Well, we can talk about, you want to go with that a little bit? Or you want to quit? You want to hit it and quit it now? Okay. Yeah, hit it and quit it. Okay, yeah, we'll make it okay. Oh, what the heck. Come on, let's go. Let's do this. It's not a whole lot. Let's do it. I can get it done in 10 minutes, okay? All right. That way we'll have more time to look at the video. Maybe I'll bring Aquila and the bee in. Okay. All right. Okay. All right, Sunnis versus Shiites. Now, I hope this works now. The different projectors do different things, you know. So, some of these things may be kind of hard to read, but we'll see what happens. All right. Okay, the Sunnis and the Shiites. Okay, remember hearing about those, right? And, the Sunnis and the Shiites, there's bad blood between them. They're mortal enemies almost, okay? Okay. So when did they split? Check this out. In the early days of Islam, there was a dispute over the rightful successor to Muhammad. Okay? There's a dispute over the rightful successor to Muhammad. The Majlis al-Sirah ruled out the traditional tribal idea of a bloodline succession. They said, we don't want a bloodline succession, we're going to elect somebody. All right. But that was a majority vote. Not all people who went along with that. Can you see that? So not everybody went along with that. So if this was Presbytery, you see, there would be a majority report and a minority report, right? And then they kick it back to General Assembly. They kick it back to the Presbyterians to mull over for the next 5 years. Okay. Okay, so they... Okay. They chose Abu Bakr, the first caliph, after Muhammad. Abu Bakr was the father of Aisha, Muhammad's second wife. Now, if you don't believe me, you can check this out. In the Al-Bukhari Hadith, remember I told you the Hadith? Volume 7, Book 62, Number 64, it says the following about Aisha. Are you ready for this? that she was 6 or 7, probably 6, when Muhammad married her, and she was 7 or 8 when he consummated the marriage. Ugh. Hello? Okay. There's your reference right there. All right. Okay, and most Muslims accepted the selection of Abu Bakr. Okay. Now, all right. Come on. What's going on? Okay. All right, a small group of Muslims supported the traditional tribal idea of a bloodline succession. And therefore, they opposed the selection of Abu Bakr. They said Abu Bakr is not legitimate. All right? And they rallied around Ali. Now, why did they rally around Ali? See, they wanted a bloodline succession. Well, Muhammad had no surviving sons. So Ali was the closest thing Muhammad had to a son because he was Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law. See? He was Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law. And so Ali was married to Fatima, who was Muhammad's daughter. All right. Now, therefore, Ali was, as I said, the closest thing that Muhammad had to a son. However, Ali, as a member of the Majlis al-Shura, voted to select Abu Bakr. So Ali was a bit of a disappointment to those who rallied around him, okay? All right. Now, here we go. Here are the Sunnis. Now, so who do the Sunnis turn out to be? The Sunnis supported Abu Bakr. And they call themselves Orthodox. That's what Sunni means, okay? All right. The Sunnis advocated the concept of the caliphate, the leadership by the caliph. The caliph is the concept of an executive-type leadership. The Sunnis have a Protestant-type view of leadership, that the caliph, though he might be important, does not have the same, does not speak with the same authority as Muhammad himself. Okay, so the Sunnis view leadership much like the Protestants. Okay, now, what about the Sunni thing? The Sunni caliphate, then, divided into 4 schools of jurisprudence. Remember, Islam is a religion of law. And so as opposed to denominations, they've got schools of jurisprudence, okay? And here are the basic schools of jurisprudence. The Hanafis, the Hanabalis, the Malikis, and the Safis. Okay, those are your 4 schools of Sunni jurisprudence. So, you know, you might be talking to a Sunni Muslim and say, hey, are you Sunni? Oh, yeah, I'm Sunni. Are you Hanafi or Maliki? Where do you get your knowledge from? Oh, yeah, by the way, dude, I'm gonna tell you, sometimes you might want to show off a little bit. And you want to talk about the Quran, you don't say Quran, say Quran. It sounds more better. Instead of saying mosque, say masjid. Oh boy, that really hurt me. They get some. Okay. So those are the Sunnis. Okay, now what about the Shiites? Remember? They opposed the selection of Abu Bakr, okay? They supported Ali. And they called themselves Shiites, meaning those who develop consensus. Alright. Now, the Shiites advocated the concept of the imamate, leadership by the imam. Okay, now, before you get confused, if you go to a Sunni mosque, a Sunni mosque is led by an imam. When we're talking about the supreme leader. The Shiites would call the supreme leader the imam, the Sunnis would call him the caliph. Okay, all right. The imamate concept reflects the belief that humanity is always in need of a divinely ordained leader and an authoritative teacher in all religious matters, and a teacher who is fully immune from sin and error. That sounds like the Pope speaking ex cathedra, see? Yeah. So the Shiites have a Catholic-type view of leadership. They view the imam as infallible and all the rest of that. Okay. All right. Now, eventually the Shiite imami divided into 3 trends. Three Shiite trends. You got the Twelvers, which is the dominant trend in Shiism, and let me kind of give you their beliefs. This is Mahmud Ahmadinejad. You're looking at his theology right here. Muhammad was succeeded by 12 divinely ordained imams. These imams were the direct descendants of Ali and Fatima. Remember the Ayatollah Khomeini of 1979? And there is another Ayatollah Khomeini in and around today. And guess what? He is a direct descendant of Fatima and Ali. Oh, by the way, you know when the Shiites go around beating themselves on the back of the chains, you know, and all the blood runs? Have you ever seen that? Well, Ali's son was martyred. And the Blue Mosque, the Blue Mosque, the one that was bombed, you know, over in Iraq, that mosque was built in honor of him. But he was martyred, and the Shiites. It's interesting. The Shiites have a theology of suffering, whereas the Sunnis don't. But anyway, that's another thing. Okay, so watch this. To reject or disobey any of these imams is to reject and disobey Muhammad himself. You see that? Okay? Now, these 12 imams have led with divine and infallible inspiration, and the 12th imam was called Muhammad al-Mahdi. Muhammad al-Mahdi. And he disappeared a few hundred years ago. And guess what? He is now known as the hidden imam who will come back. And that's who Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is looking for. Okay, he believes he's here today, and he will be revealed this year. The hidden imam will reappear, and he will inaugurate a reign of justice, and he will foretell the final judgment. Okay.
Why this year?
Huh?
Why 2007?
Why 1914 for the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know?
Do you think this figure is related to Antichrist?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. I believe I have a theory about all this. Okay, you want to hear it? Okay. If you know, we're presupposing something, you know, let's say for the sake of argument that Jesus is going to come back in the next 10 to 20 years. Okay, let's say that. Okay, no, go out here. Quote me as I see you come back 10 to 20 years. Okay. Because I can tell you right now, I know the exact moment when he's coming. I do know the exact moment when Jesus is coming, though. And you can quote me on this one. Are you ready for this? When we least expect him. Okay. But let's say Jesus is coming back in the next 10 to 20 years, okay? We talk about the beast, and we talk about, you know, Daniel, the statue with the iron and the clay and all that kind of stuff. I believe that the beast, or the beast system, or whatever, if the first thing is true, then chances are that this thing, this religious system, will be some kind of an unholy alliance between apostate Christianity and radical Islam. Apostate Christianity is the clay, radical Islam is the iron. And they together will go to war against the saints. If you notice, you see some of that stuff coming up today. You notice how the news media, they start to use Islamic fundamentalism. You know, they're using that terminology a lot. Because you know what the implication is? That Islamic fundamentalism is just as bad as Christian fundamentalism, a la Rosie O'Donnell. Right? You understand what I'm saying? And all that kind of stuff. And you see all this radical secularism, all that kind of business. I mean, it's kind of... You see what's happening in Western Europe and other places. And so I suspect that this Muhammad al-Mahdi is going to be... he'll have a great appeal across the board, you know, whoever he claims to be, you know. So that's just a theory. That's just something to think about. Okay, now the three trends, the Ismaili. Okay, first of all, you have the 12ers, right? I talked about the 12ers. That's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The Ismailis, that's another one. They accept the first six imams, but they believe that the son of the sixth imam is Ismaili. The rightful succeeding imam. So that he was the right one, all right? And his descendants continue to this day, and of course the best one known is Aga Khan, a guy named Aga Khan. You've heard of Aga Khan, all right? And then you got the Zaydis, which is the third group. They're not quite as Shiite as the other ones. They believe that the imams receive divine guidance, but they do not believe in the infallibility of the imam. So they're kind of like Shiite-like. They also reject the 12-word doctrine of the hidden imam. So if you think religiously and you look and see what Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is doing, you see he has no problem with this chaos and stuff because he believes that the hidden imam is on his way back. Okay. Yes.
So not only do they not want to be ruled by the infidel, they don't want to be ruled by each other.
That's right. Okay. Now that's why this summer, check it out, this summer, Hamas kidnapped an Israeli soldier. Right? Now what happens within a week? You know, they get a lot of press for that, right? What happens within a week? Hezbollah kidnaps too. You got it? Hamas does something, you know, the Shiites do something, you know, Hamas, the Sunni, Hezbollah, Shiite. And you're going to see this all back and forth, you know. You see one do something and the other don't do something. There's kind of a rivalry between them. Now there are some who are saying, well, we'll support the Sunnis and all that. You know what I'm saying? The Shiites say they'll support the Sunnis because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, kind of thing. But at the end of it, at the end of the day, there is great rivalry between them, and we'll see what happens. Okay, tomorrow we'll look at subdivisions. It'll be kind of a simplified review of this. Then we'll go on down to the Hadith, Sharia, Sufism, Doctrine of Abrogation, Doctrine of Deception, the World Challenge, the Extremist, the Surge in Islam. We'll go back to some history, and then we'll go back to the history of the development of Islamic thought. Yeah.
Who's Aga Khan? I actually don't.
He was a kind of a military kind of guy. He lived a couple hundred years ago, and was a great leader. Aga Khan. Look him up.
Okay.